From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, filmmaker Molly Herman's documentary tells the story of a Wisconsin man's struggle with opioid addiction.
He had such hope, and he was trying so hard to fix his life himself, really not realizing that really it wasn't possible. It's not something that people fix themselves at his kind of stage of addiction.
Later, a couple of years after the book Evicted shed light on Milwaukee's eviction issues, things haven't noticeably improved here.
We now know that there is an eviction epidemic in Milwaukee. We know that it particularly affects women and children, and African American and Latino women and children.
And we'll travel to River West for a preview of the Florentine Opera's Baroque double bill this weekend. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. In 2016, the National Institutes of Health reported that 5% of high school seniors misuse prescription drugs. In the greater Milwaukee area and the state of Wisconsin, opioid addiction has been at the forefront of news stories. In 2016 alone, 827 people here in the state died from prescription opioid overdoses, and another 371 died from heroin overdoses.
Last October, President Trump declared the opioid crisis as a public health emergency, but drug abuse and the stigma surrounding addiction continue. A Wisconsin-based documentary film, Written Off, challenges the stigma of addiction through telling Matthew Edwards' story based on his personal journals.
I must be honest within these pages. Failure to do so will render this endeavor useless. Here I can see my intake for the first time on a monthly basis. I have extrapolated the cost from memory and current prices for the stuff and where I get it. Intake, $100, heroin IV, 45 milligrams, hydroco oral, 10 milligrams, diazepam oral.
Molly Herman is the director, writer, and co-producer of the documentary Written Off, and she spoke with Audrey Nowakowski ahead of a screening in Milwaukee tomorrow night. She began by explaining what first drew her to this young Wisconsin teen's story.
Well, I do a lot of historical documentaries for cable networks, and my business partner and I had long wanted to do something that sort of came from our hearts. And I had a cousin named Emily who died of a heroin overdose when she was 20. And when I started reading about all of the opioid, it wasn't even called the opioid crisis then, but I started reading about so many people dying like she did, and it was years afterwards. So I thought, it kind of rang familiar for me, and started to think that maybe there was sort of a central question that I wanted to answer for myself, and I thought maybe other people would want to have answered, which is, how do you go from being the star basketball player like my cousin to dying with a needle in your arm? Just how does that actually function? It seems incredible. And I've heard a lot of people say, oh, I'd never use a needle. And I felt that way too. And so I was interested in trying to figure that out and ultimately to destigmatize addiction.
Right. And what was it about Matthew that stuck out to you?
Well, I had never read or, heard a story that was first person like Matt's story. He really was so honest with himself in his journals, and they were the place where he could tell the truth in a life where he couldn't do much of that, because he was always having to be secretive and to hide his addiction and, to do whatever it took to survive and deal with that huge element in his life. And he was such a eloquent, smart guy. I related to him, and I felt like he was just sort of this everyman where, I thought a lot of people would relate to him.
It is unique, especially from a filmmaker standpoint, to have this pure first-person account totally at your fingertips. So I'm curious, I imagine it was a great help, but did that also hinder your writing process because there's so much material that you can only squeeze into under an hour and a half?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, the sort of second element was that his mom, who tells his story in the film, was just fantastic and is just a woman I greatly admire, in particular for letting us in and letting us do this. But she's really has a lot of vision and wanted his life to mean more than it did in his short time on Earth. But there were so many stories that we had to be selective. And sometimes we would just have to say, like, we can't even do this thing because it's like, unbelievable. You know, people wouldn't even believe the roller coaster that his life took. And there's a ton of it in the film. But there were things that we couldn't include or that we tried. And then we just felt like, my God, we're just doing this story point of, you know, over and over again with different examples.
This spans over about 10 years from when he started his struggle with addiction to his time of death. And do you find that people often have a misconception about addiction and recovery and its lifetime commitment?
There's something that I learned while making the film that really sort of busted my assumptions, which is that I thought, like I think a lot of people, that people with addictions are weak. And I learned from Matt's story that he was a really strong guy, that the only way that he could have survived that long with all of this going on was that he was determined and he was smart and he was strong and he was a hard worker and he worked, you know, double shifts at fast food jobs to keep himself alive and housed and feed his addiction. So that was sort of one thing that has to do with the long span of time that he dealt with this. But I just don't think there was no education, you know, in his family. And he comes from, you know, a really sort of typical or maybe even sort of more educated than typical family from his neck of the woods. And it just wasn't known, you know. The idea was that you get treatment and you get it taken care of, and then it's taken care of. It's like, you know, a broken leg. But it's much more insidious, and it has a lot of sort of tentacles that impact everything. So if you've done opioids or heroin for a long period of time, your brain really forgets how to make you happy. It forgets how to make serotonin. And so then if you quit the drugs, you're really depressed and it starts to feel like anything can happen. You know, for Matt, it was winter. This extreme cold of where he was living made him so bummed out that drugs seemed to be the only kind of viable option. And I mean, honestly, it seems crazy, but I can understand how he felt that way because he just felt bereft and depressed and he just didn't have support for any of it.
In one way, he tried to change his environment. This takes place all over Wisconsin. And as we know, especially right now, winters can be very difficult. So, you know, from Matt's family and living in northern Oshkosh, from moving to a more populated city like Madison to help maybe alleviate his surroundings that would make drugs seem less appealing. You know, all these places he tried to change his life in order to help his addiction. How did you want to frame the sense of place and its major role in the story through the film?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid poor Oshkosh gets short shrift in the film. I feel bad. But it was just, you know, it was Matt's Oshkosh that was the problem. And, right, I mean, everything that he did, he tried. He had such hope, and he was trying so hard to fix his life himself, really not realizing that really it wasn't possible. It's not something that people fix themselves at his kind of stage of addiction. Yeah, I mean, Madison in the film and in Matt's mind was like Oz, really. I think he literally says that it was such a revelation to move there and, you know, in the springtime and be around people who are in school and the whole college town kind of vibe, and he loved it, but it wasn't the place he was living that was the problem for Matt. It was addiction. It would have been the same if he was in Key West.
He did have a select few people in his life who he relied on for comfort, companionship, support. What struck you the most about his impact on his family? You mentioned his mother before, and his friends' lives, who you interviewed for this story, because it is a select few for a documentary.
Yeah, you know, we were really lucky. We kind of made the rule that no one was going to be in the film who didn't know Matt. So we didn't put in addiction experts or, you know, it's not that kind of movie. You know, we hear from his girlfriend who he told a million lies to, but who I think is such a sophisticated person that even though a lot of bad stuff went down between them, that she can see clear to who she considered to be the real Matt, and that none of it devalued the love that they really had for each other. And I think that we live in a, you know, the film's called Written Off because people with addictions get written off. You know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, my, you know, uncle, or we can't deal with him anymore. He's stolen from us. And people dealing with serious addictions end up breaking a lot of social contracts, and they give us the right to just sort of write them off. And I thought that his girlfriend, who's from Poland, who he met when she was working in an exchange program in the hospitality industry in Eagle River, Wisconsin, that she really, even for a young, really young person, she got that, which I think was admirable. And then his best friend is a young woman named Rose, who had probably the most complicated relationship with him because she was the person who really knew about his addiction. She wasn't in the dark. She just didn't know what to do about it. You know, she didn't want to turn him into the police. She didn't have any idea how to get help for him. And we really struggled with her story because we didn't want people to feel like she was culpable, knowing especially that she had saved his life on many occasions, you know, talked to him on the phone all night so he wouldn't fall asleep and overdose. And it's really tricky, but it's partly that there aren't really simple answers.
Right. And there's no simple way to view a person in this light either. His mother points out, she said a particular statement that kind of stuck with me, was that addicts know they're not doing the right thing. I wish I had known that. So what do you think needs to change about the usual heroin opioid narrative? And as you said, at this time during Matt's struggle, there wasn't a lot of education for people outside of who work in recovery clinics or for family members to look for signs or to know what steps to take to possibly help the people in their lives. So what do people need to recognize today in order to change this narrative?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm not an expert on the technical side of treatment, although just traveling the country with the film, I hear a lot of people tell me that the thing that saved them was like a peer-to-peer situation. So I have some anecdotal confidence in that kind of setup. But I think the thing that really needs to change is the stigma, because the shame of an addiction and the way you're devalued in society, at least for Matt, was every bit as hard as the physical side of it. And that's what his mom means. You know, telling him he's bad, he knows he's bad. He feels terrible about it. And I think that most people who do a lot of bad things feel terrible about it. And he couldn't help it. You know, somebody said to me in a screening that not getting your fix is like being, like, they didn't know this, but they were like, I'd imagine it would be like being waterboarded. And that to me, like, sort of pointed it out, you know, because it's hard for it to feel as mandatory as something like being able to take a breath if you haven't been in it. So, yeah, I think what needs to change is looking at this group of people. You know, Jane, his mom, would always say, you know, my son wasn't some dirty junkie. And even if you look like that, you're a person of value. And that's really a big problem. We're allowed to just write these people off. You know, I kind of compare it to the beginning of the AIDS crisis, where there was a real sense in the beginning that maybe people deserved their fate. That was sort of how society was approaching it, that they were being punished for their lifestyle. There was just like a whole lot of ways that people could be written off. And that disease and movement has come so far. Like, I'll say in screenings, you know, you watch a season of Project Runway and there's always someone who comes out mid-season and says they're HIV positive, and there's like a huge group hug and tons of support. And, you know, Matt never got anything like that for his struggle.
So the scale of the crisis has only increased since his death in 2010. And, you know, there has been some legislation, some declarations of emergencies in states and across the country. But what message do people and legislators, people who have the power to impact real change, need to hear to create more quick-moving action for this crisis?
Yeah, well, I've worked a bit with Representative Annie Custer from New Hampshire, who really cares deeply about this and is working hard on it. It's hard when there isn't the funding out there. So, you know, the Trump administration recently called this a national I believe, health emergency, not a national emergency, which was the difference between millions and millions of dollars and like $50,000. Mm. So it was a really important distinction, and it was a really big disappointment for people who are worried about this. What I tell people is that they, as parents and as consumers and as patients, they should take it upon themselves to worry about this, to not allow their kids to take these drugs. If their high school student is hurt in a football accident or, you know, some other sports-related injury, that's where a lot of these kids get hooked in the first place. Educate them, tell them that these drugs aren't safe just because they are prescription, if someone gives one to them at a party. So I tell people to take it into their own hands, you know. And there's one other thing that I think is really worth talking about, because I know that this crisis is compared to the crack epidemic a lot. And the criticism, perhaps rightly, is that this gets attention because the perception is that it's white people, and the crack epidemic was African-American people in cities. And first of all, this cuts across. It's actually resembles, in terms of diversity, the country itself. So it's not just a white problem at all. But the thing that sets this apart for me from any other drug crisis is that the source of the drugs is generally your doctor, and that there's been a lot of very heavy-handed lobbying from the pharmaceutical industry, and this is a problem that's been long in coming, but it's been executed on that level. And so, you know, it's kind of like cigarettes. You know, there's even starting to be lawsuits, just like there were for big tobacco. But the thing that sets this apart is that, you know, Matt had an ingrown toenail, and that's how he got opioids for the first time. So these are really just people who are actually kind of ironically seeking out treatment for their health who get exposed to something that destroys their health and their lives in a lot of cases.
There are a series of photos at the end of the film, too. Who are these people?
We created a title sequence at the end of the film that are people who, just like Matt and my cousin, she's in there, have died from addiction. We wanted to show that the diversity of the epidemic cuts across. So that sequence at the end of the film is demographically the same as the problem in the country. So it cuts across, and it really just reflects the population.
How do you hope Written Off will resonate with audiences?
Well, I showed this film recently in a small town in Vermont, and a woman got up and said at the end, my son has been addicted for a decade, and until I saw this movie, I had no idea what he went through. And that's it. You know, that's what I'm interested in people understanding. I think that when you take a group of people whose illness makes them break all their social contracts, makes them really tough to love in a lot of ways, you have to work extra hard to understand what they're going through. And, you know, it's a tough one. And there's a lot of parents out there who will never give up no matter what. And it would be helpful for them if they didn't have to also feel ashamed, if their kids or their loved ones didn't have to feel ashamed. And if there was a community out there who understood how this thing ticked and understood that somebody who's dealing with addiction isn't morally bankrupt or whatever other kind of convenient ideas that people tend to have.
Well, Molly Herman, thank you so much for taking the time to speak about Written Off. And it's a very well done documentary that does Matt's story justice, I think.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
Molly Herman is the director, writer, and co-producer of the documentary Written Off. There's a screening of the documentary on Thursday at the Landmark Oriental Theater, presented by the Light and Unite Red Committee, led by the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Division.
The event is free but requires a reservation for the screening and panel discussion to follow. For more information about Written Off and the event, please go to WUWM.com.
A short break now, and when we return, writer Barbara Miner shares the story of her essay on the heartbreak of evictions in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. We spoke with sociologist Matthew Desmond a couple of years ago as his book Evicted was just coming out. The book went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction as it shed light on the scope of the eviction crisis in the U.S. in general and in Milwaukee in particular.
It is 2018 and eviction is still a problem here. Writer Barbara Miner explores the issue in an essay in the January issue of Milwaukee Magazine. She'll share the essay with us in a few minutes, but first, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch. Always a pleasure.
Give us a little perspective on what inspired you to write this essay.
Well, in a word, my grandson, my new grandson. And, you know, all parents, all grandparents think that they're experiencing this miracle for the first time, and no one else ever realizes quite what a miracle it is. Clearly, I've had children, so it wasn't like I was unaware of newborns. But there was just something about holding this, you know, 10-day-old baby in my arms and this just overwhelming sense that we are responsible for this child. You know, it is completely dependent on adults for survival. And I just, you know, I joke with my daughter, you know, keep him alive, keep him alive. That's all that really matters. And then when I read a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article a few days later about a young 27-day-old infant with a heart condition, evicted from his home, died the next morning. And like all tragedies, we'll never completely know. But it just broke my heart.
As you think about these two divergent stories, this is not an easy thing to sit down and put to paper.
No, it was very difficult. And, you know, it was during a time and continuing to be during a time where issues of inequality, especially racial inequality, are just at the heart and center of our national discussion. And, you know, for a long time I was thinking maybe I shouldn't write anything because here I am, white woman, middle-class child. Here's, you know, African-American young boy, Central City. But I realized that, one, I just felt I had to do something to try and point out these just heartbreaking inequalities. And two, you know, my husband and I have talked about this a lot. One reaction of whites in the face of issues of race is to just say nothing. And I actually think that whites do have a responsibility, certainly to allow African Americans, Latinos, to set the tone, set the discussion. But whites have a responsibility to point at and try and deal with racism as well.
There's been a significant amount of attention paid to eviction in American cities in the wake of the Matthew Desmond book. But the temptation to think that things have changed because of it seems like, as you found, things haven't changed.
Well, unfortunately, things have gotten worse. And that's what I find disturbing. Clearly, you know, Matthew Desmond's book came out in 2016, Evicted, Profit and Private Property in an American City. It's about Milwaukee. And, you know, in 2011 and 2014, the state legislature, the Republicans passed bills. I call them landlord protection bills because what they really did was decrease protections for renters and mandated that this was statewide. So here we have now in 2018 a third bill that would increase landlord protections. And so you can't really say, well, the first two, no one really realized how bad evictions were, because we now know that there is an eviction epidemic in Milwaukee. We know that it particularly affects women and children and African American and Latino women and children. So it's not like you can claim ignorance.
We should hear this essay at this point, if you'd like to share it with us.
Thank you, Mitch, and bear with me my stumblings and mumblings. I arrived in Brooklyn last July to experience a miracle. I held my first grandchild, 10-day-old Cashel Alexander. Overwhelmed by how small and fragile and precious he was, I sometimes joked with my daughter, keep him alive, all else is commentary. 2 days later, that offhand joke sickened my stomach. I was skimming through JS Online and a headline caught my eye, quote, how 6 Milwaukee kids died in 5 days. The first death, I had difficulty reading any further. The first death involved Miguel Henderson, a preterm baby with an ailing heart. Miguel died the day after he, his mother, and three siblings were evicted from their Northside home. Miguel was 27 days old. While in Brooklyn, I would look at Cashel, think of Miguel, and be tempted to say, "There but for the grace of God." But I knew that grace had nothing to do with it. Cashel is white, of middle-class parents. Miguel was black, evicted from a home in Milwaukee's Central City. Months later, I still can't wrap my head around Miguel's death. One question, above all, lingers. How could anyone, especially landlords, judges, sheriff deputies, how could anyone allow the eviction of a premature newborn in delicate health? Do we, as a society, believe that is acceptable public policy? Miguel's story received 139 words in the newspaper. Based on Google searches, there was no television or radio coverage that mentioned his name. According to state data, roughly 15,000 people were evicted in Milwaukee County in 2016, slightly more than the population of Whitefish Bay. A disproportionate number of those evicted were women and children. Less than 1% had an attorney. And I wonder, if everyone in Whitefish Bay had been evicted last year, wouldn't officials have put a stop to such madness? And if nothing else, the media would have gone crazy. In 2016, Matthew Desmond wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book based on Milwaukee, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. And Desmond documents how Milwaukee's housing market systematically helps landlords make substantial money off poor people. That the problem isn't just that poor people have trouble paying rent, but that the housing and eviction market is structured to increase profits for Central City landlords. Now, the book received extensive local publicity, almost as if there were reason to be proud that a book about Milwaukee won the Pulitzer Prize, even though the book reflected horribly on the city. But there were no outcries for change. At some point in our state's history, we had the compassion to pass a law preventing utilities from being shut off in winter, apparently believing we should not allow people to freeze to death. And I asked Rafael Ramos, head of Legal Action of Wisconsin's Eviction Defense Project, if there were a similar statute preventing evictions of people with serious medical conditions. He couldn't think of one. Nor is there a moratorium on wintertime evictions. Miguel lived in a single-family bungalow near 47th Street and West Meineke Avenue. The family had planned to sleep in their van after the eviction June 5th, but snuck back inside when it got chilly. In the morning, the baby was unresponsive. The medical examiner's autopsy report lists the cause and manner of death as, quote, undetermined. It notes a history of co-sleeping and cites the baby's prematurity and heart condition. There was no evidence of injury. As with most tragedies, there are more questions than answers. But ultimately, the heartbreak of Miguel's death goes beyond his story and speaks to the ongoing epidemic of evictions in Milwaukee. City of Milwaukee records list the home's owner as J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. When I went by in late September, the home was abandoned, with four-foot weeds, broken windows, and unpainted, rickety porch steps. The tragedy of Miguel was compounded by the tragedy of a blighted house on a block of modest but well-maintained bungalows in a neighborhood struggling for respectability. Miguel Edward Henderson Jr., meanwhile, was buried June 16th at Graceland Cemetery in a section known as, quote, Babyland. It was described by one Graceland worker as the saddest place in the cemetery. This fall, I visited Miguel's grave, inexplicably compelled to extend my condolences. I whispered the only thing that seemed appropriate. May he rest in peace.
Writer Barbara Miner's essay is in the January issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link to it at wuwm.com.
Next on the show, we travel to River West to visit the Florentine Opera's rehearsal space and get a preview of one of the two Baroque operas on stage this weekend. That's when Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Music historians generally agree that Western opera began around the turn of the 17th century in Europe. However, the modern repertoire has generally ignored the first 150 years or so in favor of the works of the mid-19th century to the early 20th century. Think of people like Puccini, Verdi, and Wagner. They're the ones who get a lot of attention.
It has only been in the last few decades that the earlier operas have been gaining a wider audience. The Florentine Opera is staging two early English operas this weekend, Venus and Adonis by John Blow and Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell. It is a fairly recent development that the Florentine has dipped its toe into the Baroque opera waters. They started in 2009 with a production of Handel's Semele.
This double bill this weekend is being led from the harpsichord by Great Lakes Baroque founder Jory Vinokur. It's the first time the Florentine has actually used a period orchestra comprised of Baroque period instruments rather than modern ones. WUWM's audio engineer Jason Reavy and I took a trip up to Florentine's rehearsal space in River West to meet Vinokur, along with artistic director Bill Florescu and mezzo-soprano Sandra Pekes-Eddie, who is singing the role of Dido. Pekes-Eddie began by explaining the significance this role has had in her career.
I heard Dido's Lament in a formative analysis class at Boston Conservatory when I was an undergrad music education major. So I had some voice lessons during the week, but I didn't have any idea. I had no idea what opera was at that time. I loved musical theater. So when I was in this room listening to Dr. Bell play Janet Baker's recording of Dido's Lament, he was trying to just demonstrate what a ground bass was. So I heard this music and immediately was taken by the feeling that was behind it, the word painting, the way the singer used her voice like an instrument. It spoke to me. And honestly, that afternoon I went to the library and I got the recording and I listened to it on a record maybe a dozen times over and over and over again. I was just in love with opera because of Janet Baker singing Dido's Lament.
And you get to finally sing it.
I do get to finally sing it. It's a dream. It's a dream come true.
It is one of the most famous arias, certainly in Baroque opera, but mm-hmm. in all of opera. And Jory, give us a little history of this piece and where this aria fits in. Was opera changing at that particular time?
Opera was certainly changing, and opera was a great novelty in England to such a point that it's very difficult to know whether we can define our two works, Venus and Adonis by John Blow and Dido and Aeneas of Henry Purcell, as fully fledged operas, or are they masks? We find a manuscript about one century after the composition of Dido, but somebody has recopied this and written Dido and Aeneas a mask. So these are semi-theatrical pieces. They may have been performed with the acts interspersed with spoken text, and yet today, 350-some-odd years later, we do definitely perceive them as operas with a tragic story being told with music, thorough composed. So they're terribly important, and especially important in the history of English-language opera.
And so, Bill, you've done Baroque opera here before. Why put these two together? What was it about these two? Is it because of that historical import?
It was. I mean, when I decided to do, Dido was my starting point, and I wanted to pair it up. And because of the connection between Purcell and Blow as composers, but also the fact that Purcell was sort of inspired structurally by what Blow had done with Venus and Adonis. And then also, from a more pragmatic standpoint, being able to double cast the roles, all except for Dido, it just made a lot of sense. The length of the works, everything about it, I thought made a really wonderful evening together. So it was. It also gave me a chance to scratch my very rudimentary musicological itch that I have. So it was fun to do the research on it.
Dig into it and find
exactly.
out.
Were
you going to jump in? I was going to say, it's also pretty, it's great that there's also reference to Venus in Dido and Aeneas. So you'll hear the word.
Aeneas is the son of Venus.
When you're setting this up, and this is a question for all of you, when you're doing a work like this that isn't what we think of as a fully dramatic work, say, like Tosca, how do you inject, besides the music, how do you inject the drama?
I sort of, and I don't think it's even a contrarian view anymore, but I sort of reject the notion that they're not, by their nature, dramatic. I think both of these works have, yes, there's gods and goddesses and nymphs and shepherds and all of that, but the relationships, particularly sort of building backwards from each piece, both end with these beautiful dirge choruses, and you have to believe them, because otherwise it just, I think it's an unsatisfying evening. So I sort of build backwards from those final choruses, and you have to inject reality into it. And the writing is so wonderful that the relationships are there. So we do have some places where we buy into the formality of it, particularly in the dance portions. But aside from that, I feel that they're very, very flesh and blood. I think that's a starting point for me.
I absolutely agree with Bill. I notice in both operas there are crucial scenes which transpire off stage, if you will, whether it's Adonis being killed by a wild boar. We don't see any part of that action. We find Adonis dying in the arms of Venus after a rather amusing interlude with Cupid and the little Cupids learning about love. And yet I agree with Bill, these are absolutely flesh and blood characters. Mm-hmm. They were meant to touch to the heart. At the time this was written, 1683 or so, and a couple of years later for Dido, and I think they still touch us today.
Everybody's talking about the relationships, but that's exactly the first thing that I thought of with these relationships. You see with, let's say, with Belinda and Dido, she's trying to help her at the very beginning of the opera. She's pressed with torment. She's laden with sadness. But when you hear it in the music, it's just slightly different every time we sing it, or we hope it's slightly different every time we sing a repeat. So we're trying to flesh out the characters a little bit. For me, my challenge or the thing that I really get excited about is really finding vulnerability in this very strong, seemingly strong woman, and fleshing that out where it's not just one color all the time, where she is the Queen of Carthage, but she has very real emotion. She's a
human,
really
emotion. Human.
Yeah, she's a woman. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a certain formality in the music too, but the Baroque also, and we've talked about this in other interviews, where there's this room for expression. Mm-hmm. You have certain structures that are very real, but there's a lot of room on top of it.
And this is very interesting. I think I addressed a very brief opinion the first day of rehearsal, but Dido, in fact, is in a sense a very brief role, and she expresses her emotions over two great ground bass pieces. And Sandy mentioned towards the beginning of this interview being carried away by the lament, which is built on a chromatically descending ground bass. And this is going to be fleshed out and harmonized with a famous tune that we're going to hear in a moment. But the first thing we hear from Dido is another repetitive bass where she sings of her anguish and she cannot express her torment. Of course, she's just in love with the handsome visitor. So to have a bookend of one ground bass trying to find meaning, and then the final very dirge-like funeral ground bass. I think this is fascinating. It's formalistic but so moving.
It is, and it allows you in that wonderful lament to really be so expressive.
Expressive, absolutely.
And it's just, it's there supporting you, mm-hmm. doing that. Let's do a little bit of music geek techiness here for a minute. Talk a little bit about ground bass and what that means in Baroque music in general.
It's interesting to note that in French Baroque opera this time, I'm thinking principally of Jean-Baptiste Lully, most of his operas, if not all of them, will feature at some point a chaconne, which is another type of repetitive bass piece. The most famous is perhaps from Armide, which is another type of tragedy, where you'll get the chorus and dance and some soloists over this constantly repeating piece, yet very kaleidoscopic. Purcell uses this rather differently. So the English ground bass has its own character. It is quite unusual. We don't find it in John Blow's Venus. We just find it in Purcell to have two big vocally based ground basses.
And so musically, it is a phrase that just repeats.
The bass phrase repeats. The harmonies are constantly transforming and modulating over this. And I find this very kaleidoscopic. There is a fixed bass, and yet what happens over that bass can develop and be very different, including the singer's melody, of course, but also the harmonies underlaying that melody.
When you step into Baroque opera versus a more classical role, mm-hmm. what do you change, if anything?
It's funny. I was thinking about this morning, actually. When I've sung Popea before, and I remember singing it overseas, and the rest of the cast were Baroque specialists. So a lot of the countertenors only sang Baroque opera. And I remember thinking, I feel like I want to be part of this club, you know, because I felt so, I had such adoration, like I just admire the skill that it takes to sing Baroque opera and to play Baroque opera. But the more experience I got singing and rehearsing, I just felt like it is like using your voice as an instrument. And it's such a freeing experience to express your emotions vocally as well as physically. So I'm always looking for opportunities to sing more Handel, more Monteverdi.
And so, Bill, for you and looking at what Florentine, where you are, where you want to go, is there going to be more Baroque opera on the bill?
Absolutely. It's funny, in our name, the Florentine Opera is named for the Florentine Camerata. So, we lived most of our lives, the Florentine Opera lived most of its life, smack dab in the middle of the genre. And what I've tried to do is have us live more on the bookends of the genre. And I, for one, I love Rigoletto and Traviata. I always feel that I come to those pieces then with new ears when I start with a world premiere or I do something Baroque. I think it's a great way, in addition to just the value they have on their own, of sort of shaking and scraping some of the barnacles off of what we do in the standard repertory. I think they benefit from that. But I love this genre in particular. I always have. And, we didn't do our first Baroque opera until 2009 with Semele. But I found our audience really likes it. We're in a city where early music now, and now what Jory is doing with Great Lakes Baroque, there's an appetite for it. And plus, again, putting on the executive director's half of my job versus the artistic director, it tends to be a bit more cost effective than Aida and things like that. So,
no elephants.
In those few instances where art and financial responsibility actually intersect, it's a smart move to seize those when you can. So for me, it hits all the right cylinders. But first and foremost, they're great pieces, and I think our audience deserves to hear from whence we came. And you think about how Shakespeare still holds a central place in the theater world. Well, I think early opera deserves that same type of flesh and blood approach to it.
So is this the beginning of a beautiful relationship between Great Lakes Baroque and Florentine Opera?
Well, so far, Jory and I have shared drinks, and we haven't thrown harpsichords or stage directions
no
at each other.
Or so, anything, yeah.
Actually, the cliche about historically informed musicians is that they tend to be as dry as dust, and not about really supporting and being a part of what happens and being flesh and blood with it. Jory belies all of those stereotypes. He's an incredibly supportive accompanist, both in the real sense of actually playing at the harpsichord, but also how he's approaching the pieces musically. And he really approaches them in a very alive standpoint. It's not pallid.
Academic. I never think of academic when I think of you.
Yeah, it's academic. It's academically informed,
yes.
but energetically and very enthusiastically executed.
And I think
that's an important thing. So at least from my standpoint, from the Florentine standpoint, I would certainly hope so, for sure.
Bill makes this very, very easy. We have a beautiful show. He's extraordinarily well prepared. This is a sensitive and beautiful staging. So I feel just like swimming in this. I did want to point out one thing. Bill mentioned that Semele was the first Baroque opera that Florentine did back in 2009. This is the first time that a period instrument orchestra is participating in a Florentine production.
Well, let us end, if we could, with Dido's Lament. And if whoever would like to set up where we are and what is happening, and then we'll set up for the actual performance.
So at this point, Dido and Aeneas had their fight, and she says, "Away to death I'll fly," and she sends him off, and she's told him that she will die without him. So she takes poison, and she kills herself, and this is what she sings after the poison. And she's speaking to Belinda, saying, you know, "Remember me, forget my fate, may my wrongs create no trouble in thy breast." So it's so painfully beautiful. And I'm just so glad to get to sing this. Thank you.
Mezzo-soprano Sandra Peaks Eddy, accompanied by Jori Vinokur and Ruben Pirinen, performed Dido's Lament from Henry Purcell's opera Dido and Aeneas. The Florentine Opera will perform the entire opera on a double bill with John Blow's Venus and Adonis at the Marcus Center's Vogel Hall this weekend. Bill Florescu is the Florentine's artistic director.
We spoke with him at the Florentine's rehearsal space in River West, and there is more information at WUWM.com. Lots of thanks to Jason Reavy for recording that for us. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.